From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, open lines. Here's what's happening. Well, if you got some money, you might be going to Mars. SpaceX CEO Elon Musk has unveiled plans for a spacecraft and a rocket project that intends to put intelligent life on Mars. That's us, human life. In a speech at the International Astronautical Congress in Guadalajara, Mexico, Musk has announced that SpaceX will develop an interplanetary rocket and capsule designed to move roughly 100 people and their cargo to the Red Planet. Musk said it would be a super exciting adventure, also dangerous, at least initially. Now, he has estimated that a ticket runs about $10 billion per person today, but he outlined four ways to make the ticket price hover between $100,000 and $200,000. We'll see what happens. On Friday, September 30th, a very rare black moon will occur, which many are linking to the apocalypse. The spectacular black moon occurs when the illuminated side of the moon is caught in the shadow of the Earth, making it virtually impossible to see. The phenomenon happens roughly every 32 months, but this one holds special significance because of other universal activity that's going on this month. Well, viewers unhappy with the questions asked at Monday's debate will have a chance to weigh in before Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton meet again on October 9th in St. Louis. For the first time, the networks producing the town hall event and the debate have agreed to accept questions voted on through the internet as well. Now, Greg Hunter, of course, has had 9 years network experience as an investigative correspondent, and here he is. Greg, I want your reaction to the debates yesterday.
The debate with Donald Trump versus Lester Holt, NBC News, and Hillary Clinton, you mean that debate? Not a single hard question. I mean, we're talking about who can be president of the United States. You know, during the FBI interview, 39 times, 40 times, she's, I don't know, I don't remember. You didn't remember getting classified training? I hit my head. Her chief of staff got, Cheryl Mills got immunity. Huma Abedin worked for the State Department, the Clinton Foundation, another company that funneled business to the Clinton Foundation all at the same time. She was referred to by Congress for a perjury a charge with the FBI. The FBI Director Comey said that she lied multiple times to the public about using devices and lied about her email scan. None of that was brought up. It's too stupid to be stupid.
Why didn't he bring any of it up? Trump could have used it.
Well, the scuttlebutt after the Matt Lauer interview, who actually, the presidential forum, actually acted like a reporter, and she was livid. I mean, she called, supposedly, called up executives at Comcast and raised holy, you know, heck. And so that was unbelievable. And I think she won on form, but she lost on message. And I'll tell you a funny little story. I'm watching this thing right afterwards, and I go to Drudge, and she's like 82% to 18%, and I go to Breitbart, and she's 75%. He's 75%.
He is, yeah.
Trump is leading. 82% to her 18%. Trump is 75% on Breitbart to her 24%, 25%. And I go, MSNBC, let's take a look at that. I go to MSNBC, and I think, oh my gosh, it's about the same as Breitbart. I mean, and this is MSNBC. A couple of minutes later, I go back, I look again, the poll's gone. They took it down. And Trump won in every poll, including Time Magazine and CNBC, which is hardly a right-wing organization. He won big on message. Could he have done better? Yeah, but he won on the message. He won, and this is Hillary Clinton, who couldn't remember 39 times all kinds of stuff about the email thing, but she can remember Trump being sued in 1973 for discrimination. What is it?
So you thought this debate was what?
I thought, even though it was rigged in Donald Trump's favor, rigged in Hillary Clinton's favor, I'm sorry, and she even at one point said, Lester, I mean, this has already been gone over. I mean, she tried to get Lester to cut him off, but the biggest thing that was glossed over, and this is huge, and that was Donald Trump criticizing the Fed, and he's warning about how they've done a terrible job, and he says, quote, if you raise interest rates even a little bit, that's going to come crashing down.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a big, fat, ugly bubble. Nobody said anything about this. When's the last time you heard a presidential candidate talk about a big, fat, ugly bubble? He's absolutely right, according to David Stockman and many other people. We are in the biggest financial bubble in history. And when this thing blows, oh, and I think Donald Trump is setting up the Fed for a month from now, a week from now, next year, whatever, to say, I told you, I've been warning about this. He also warned about it in other debates, including the Republican debates, and everybody just glosses over this.
Well, every expert on my program tells the same thing, so he's listening in. Greg, thank you. Greg's website, usawatchdog.com. Keith Lamont Scott, that 43-year-old North Carolina man, shot and killed after a confrontation with Charlotte police, allegedly stabbed his wife, hit one of his children, and threatened to kill his family. His wife claimed this in multiple requests for domestic violence protective orders, one of which she filed last year. Meanwhile, it's reported that he was carrying a stolen gun when he was shot and killed during this confrontation. The gun was reported stolen after a breaking and entering case. The breaking and entering suspect told agents that he had stolen the gun and sold it to Scott. That man is also in custody now. Reports of killer clowns have emerged in new three states as Virginia, Florida, and Colorado struggle with internet rumors and reported sightings that have left several towns shaken. Residents and authorities in Palm Bay, Florida, for example, have been on high alert since a resident reported seeing two creepy clowns staring at her from across a road as she walked her dog. Also in Florida, deputies are concerned after it emerged that a Facebook viral video depicting a clown standing silently on the side of the road in the dark had been filmed along a main thoroughfare in that area as well. In Peru, a woman accused of being a witch was burned alive on a bonfire in an indigenous community in a remote part of the country's Amazon there. Consumer and technology stocks led gains on Wall Street after the debates. But why? Let's check in with Catherine Austin Fitz on her take of the debates and what's going on. Hi, Catherine.
You know, I have to agree with Greg. I think the economy, you know me, George, I'm always the optimist. I'm always saying we're going to slow burn. I think we're in for real trouble after the election. If you look at what's happening with Wells Fargo, Deutsche Bank, some of the different banks, and now we have the Department of Justice Inspector General saying $6.5 trillion went missing at the end of the year 2015 after $2.2 trillion undocumentable adjustments during the year. I thought one of the greatest points that got made last night was Trump said, he said, we spent $6 trillion in the Middle East, and now the Middle East is imploding. That's enough money to fix up the country two times over. We have $20 trillion of debt, nothing to show for it. You know, so I think it was the voice of accountability saying, we've got a real problem. And so I have to tell you, I agree with Craig, and I think after the election, we're in for some real rough times.
Well, I think so, and I think both candidates, Catherine, are probably hoping if the bubble bursts, it happens before they're sworn in.
What? I don't, you know, here's the thing.
They don't want it to happen when they're in office.
This is not a correction. This is a very deep problem and a very deep change. So this is going to unfold because it's a retirement system problem. At the end of the day, as I always said, you know, the financial coup d'etat was about stealing all the money before we spent it on nursing homes.
That's right.
So it's been the outliers like Puerto Rico and Detroit that have been the problem, but now it's going to come and hit home in the institutions, many of which have always been considered highly reputable. So, you know, this is a fundamental deep deficit in the economy. And here's the interesting thing. The problem at the root of it is productivity. We've been centralizing the economy in a way that destroys productivity. We've been using government regulation and laws to destroy productivity. And, you know, we've outside of the Constitution. So we've been running the money in Washington outside the Constitution. It's time we enforce the Constitution. You see an effort going to change the Constitution. We don't need to change the Constitution. It's perfectly fine. We need to enforce it. So, I think we're coming in for a deep, deep change. And I think what Trump is trying to say, when Greg said Trump was talking, you know, one on message, he's saying, you know, we have to face these things. We have to deal with these things. And we can't have, you know, we can't have another 10 or 20 years of same old, same old. Same old, same old is not working.
We're going to be talking to Catherine about this a lot on Monday night. She'll be here with me in the studio, and we'll be taking your calls that night with her as well. And by the way, her new Solari report has just come out. It is fantastic. Catherine, thank you. In a moment, we'll be talking to the godfather of reality TV. John Barber joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Great couple hours for you. Then we'll have 2 hours of open lines for you as well. John Barber is known as the godfather of reality television. Now, he created, co-hosted, co-produced, and wrote Real People. That was the first reality show. It was number one on NBC for a number of years in the 80s. Now, for 30 years, he worked to tell the story of former New Orleans DA Jim Garrison. Now, he was the man who tried to bring Clay Shaw to trial for his role in conspiring to kill John Kennedy. And Barbara succeeded in the mid-1990s with his award-winning documentary, The Garrison Tapes. It's an amazing documentary as well. John, we have followed your career for years. Welcome to the program.
Oh, George, thank you so much. I mean, after all these years of listening to you, it's a delight to be talking to you and not sitting here like I have been for the last 18 hours talking to myself. And I think that lady that you mentioned in Carolina saw the same thing that Greg saw when she said she saw two killer clowns.
Yeah, oh my God. Unbelievable situation
and then,
there.
Of course, I love Catherine Austin Fitz. And to me, one of the only really interesting things political that I could see, and I saw it on the internet and saw a bit of it on C-SPAN, was Elizabeth Warren yelling at the CEO of Wells Fargo that he should be going to prison and because he had made so much money illegally. And, of course, the next day he went to prison and he bopped.
And today the board there of Wells Fargo has yanked $40-some million of bonus money they were going to give him.
Yes, that's what I heard. But do you know that during the Second World War, under Harry Truman, there were a number of CEOs who went to prison for profiteering during the war, and one of them who was seriously fined was Prescott Bush, who was Bubba's grandfather, right?
That's exactly
those
right.
Those things do not exist in America any longer. I mean, there are dozens of people on Wall Street who should be in prison, and there are people like at Halliburton who should be in prison. And, of course, not to mention Dick Cheney, but speaking a little bit about last night, yesterday I got home about 4 o'clock from editing a new documentary I'm working on. It's part two of the Garrison.
Oh, good for you. That'll be great. We'll talk about that in a second.
Okay. Anyway, so I thought, well, George may want to talk to me a little bit about my impressions of the debate, so I'll get a little rest. So I lay down in front of the TV set at 4 o'clock, and I fell asleep, and I woke up 2 minutes before 6, and of course, that's when the debate started, and I woke up just in time to miss it. I had a great sleep, and that I didn't want to wake up to an absolute real nightmare. What they reminded me of, George, is my Toyota. Two faulty windbags, airbags, that need to be recalled. I mean, if either one gets into the White House, now it's either if you're voting for Hillary, you're sailing the Titanic. If you're voting for Trump, you're flying the Hindenburg. But if either one gets into office, it is truly going to be a democracy. And democracy is spelled D-U-M-B, democracy. That's it. This morning, I got up, a guy down the street, it's very Republican, okay?
Well, which is okay. You know, they can be what they want to be.
And he has a flag. There's nothing wrong with, in our community, you're allowed to have a flag. It's a tall flagpole up there. This morning, it was half-mast, and he had a sign under it.
Really?
And I watched the debates last night, which I thought was
Well, you know what's interesting? I watched the debates, John, and Hillary was slick compared to Donald, but with these unscientific polls, other than CNN, he slaughtered her.
Well, I didn't watch it, so I just couldn't bring myself to watch it. Now, Hillary, has a running mate named Tim Kaine who speaks Spanish. So this may be the first time in American political history that a presidential candidate and a vice presidential candidate will be lying to us in two different languages. And you have seen, you know what? If you look back at history, George, probably the greatest liar in history now, if you look at America today, is Abraham Lincoln. And you know why?
How come? What happened?
He said, government of the people and by the people and for the people. And if a candidate said that today, the CIA would off him also. And you've heard a lot of people saying that if either Trump or Hillary gets in, they're going to leave the country. Well, it's too late because Catherine Austin Fitz just mentioned it. It's the Constitution, George, and the Bill of Rights. They are the foundation of this country, and they have already left us. So these folks might just stay here. You remember Frank Zappa?
Yeah, I sure do.
Yeah, well, Frank was a very close friend of mine. Whenever I had shows in Los Angeles, he would always come on as a guest. And his father was in the intelligence service. A lot of people don't know that. And Frank said in one of my shows something that I've absolutely never forgotten. He says, John, politics in America is the entertainment division of the military-industrial complex.
That's true.
That was,
he was
so
right.
Smart. And then, of course, Mark Twain, he said, America's greatest writer, America's greatest wit, and that's something else that has disappeared from the country, is that kind of wit. He said almost 100 years ago, if voting made a difference, they wouldn't let us do it. You and I would have had as much luck voting for the Pope as we would for a president if you want anything to change in this country. In this country today, voting is like owning one share in General Motors. I own a few shares of General Motors, and I get to vote every once in a while, okay? But my vote for General Motors, I have no say over the design of the car. I have no say over the design of the carburetor, and I can't tell them who to crash into. Okay? You have absolutely no chance here. Not one chance in a million. Now, there were 80 million viewers to this.
A record.
It is a record. It is the record. You know who was watching, George? Those 80 million Americans who were watching?
Well, I was one of them.
Well, okay. You were one of them. The other 79,999,000 were federal employees, all employed by TSA. Looks like people who couldn't get jobs at Church's Chicken.
We should tell people, John, that you're also a comedian.
Well, I became a comedian in self defense, but I must tell you, I was in Washington, D.C. a week and a half ago. I had to fly to Boston for a couple of days. Then I had to go to D.C., and the reason I went to D.C. is I was delivering to the Justice Department something. You know, you well know, George, that 37, 38 years ago, the House Select Committee didn't want to, but Gary Mack had found a dictabelt of a motorcycle officer who had left the dictabelt open, recorded the shots, at least four shots. So they had to conclude there was a conspiracy.
That's right.
And they turned it over to the Justice Department for further prosecution. Of course, the Justice Department has done nothing.
They buried it, didn't they?
They have buried it. What I did, when I interviewed Jim Garrison on September 25th for 3 hours in 1980, he said to me, John, there, I can give you the names right now of people walking around who should be arrested. Some of those people, believe it or not, are still alive. Anyway, what I did is the closing of the documentary. I'm halfway through editing now, but I delivered something to the Justice Department to remind them that the case was still an open case and there were people still alive to whom they should talk about finding out who the perpetrators of that crime were. So anyway, that's going to...
All right, John, stay with us. We're going to hit the commercial break. John Barber with us. We're going to talk about his work, his documentary on the JFK assassination, and so much more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to be back in a moment with John Barber as we talk about his documentary, The Garrison Tapes, and the second one he's working on, that incredible story about the assassination of JFK. Now, Garrison, of course, was the former, late now he's departed, New Orleans district attorney who tried to claim that there was a conspiracy. So we're going to talk about that. Garrison, by the way, was absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And welcome back to Coast, John Barber with us, of course, known as the godfather of reality TV. And John, before we get into the Garrison tapes, let's go back a little bit to your career. Born in Toronto, how'd you make your way over to the U.S.?
Well, I was born in a Salvation Army hospital. First sound I ever heard was a tambourine. And I came from a severely dysfunctional family long before it was popular. My father left in 1939 to go to the peace and quiet of World War II, and I almost never saw my mother. My mother was a serious drinker, and I guess you would call her an nymphomaniac. I hate to say that, but I had about 18 uncles by the time I was 7 years of age, and I was mostly out in the streets by that time. And I spent most of my time alone in a theater on Kingston Road, a little theater called the Manor Theater. For 5 cents, you could see a double feature. And I was slightly small, and my defense, of course, was my mouth. And for some reason or other, when I was about 12 or 13 or 14, I became seriously addicted to gambling. And I would gamble with men who were 30, 35, maybe 40 all the time.
What did you do? Gamble on what?
On cards. We played cards all the time.
Okay.
And I never studied at school, but I always got very, very high grades. And it's terrible to say, but when you're not loved, if a human being is like almost like a machine, if a machine is plugged into the electricity, it functions. And if you're not loved, you're unplugged and you don't function properly. So I was a delinquent, and I was kind of mouthy. When I was younger, George, you probably remember this too. You probably in St. Louis, if that's where you grew up, you probably never saw any fat people, right?
Well, I was in Detroit, but I did see heavy people.
I only saw one fat person when I was a youngster. It was a teat bar, each eighth grade teacher. His name was Hetherington, very British and very fat. He had to have a special chair to sit down, okay? He was always mean to all of the kids all of the time, and all he did was complain about everything in his life. And then one day he came in and he sat down before class, and he sort of leaned forward and grumbled to himself. He said, "Oh, my ankles are swollen." So from the back of the room I said, "How can you tell?" Well, he roared.
The comedian is born, right?
And he grabbed me and pulled me into the principal's office. Now, in those days, you could admonish a child with corporal punishment. And the principal, what they would do is they put a leather metal strap in lemon water so it would hurt more. They'd pull out your hands, and they'd lash your hands so they would almost bleed. Now, I don't know if that ever happened to you.
No.
Maybe you remember an adult saying this to you, though, once. This hurts me more than it hurts you.
Oh, we've always heard that. That's
always true.
Well,
my hand is bleeding. And the principal says to me, "John, this hurts me more than it hurts you." So I said to him, "Well, sir, if you'd really like to hurt me more, give me that thing so I can hit you." Well, I thought he was going to punch me. He started laughing so hard. So that was a sense to me that a sense of humor would be my defense. Anyway, I got deeply involved in gambling. And I would steal occasionally. I'd steal from some of my uncles that fell asleep on the floor with my mother. I'd steal a little from my mother, and I'd go out and I'd play poker with these guys. And these guys were always sort of picking on me. And I'm still not. I'm only 5 feet, 7 and a half,
yeah,
156 pounds. Oh, and by the way, the reason I brought up TSA is when I went from Boston to Washington and back again, they strip searched me. And I had, now listen, I look like a senior citizen.
Well, you're 83, aren't you?
Yeah, and I had a T-shirt on in front of me that said, the world's oldest gigolo. And so they stopped and, listen, if they're going to strip search you, please let somebody from the opposite sex do it. Because you get really nervous when it's a guy and he's down your pants. And then they turned me around and they got upset because the sign said, you can't afford me. Anyway, I saw guys going through who were 6 feet two, dark hair, dark eyes, carrying knapsacks that looked like they had pressure cookers.
Yeah, yeah.
It would never stop. Anyway, with these guys, when I was gambling, they would always pick on me because I never smoked and I never drank. These guys would drink.
And how old were you then?
I was about 14, 13, jeez, 14, okay, 15. I did this for 2 years.
That's a kid still.
And I lost everything. I would stay even, and, you know, it would be $40 or $30, but to a 12, 13, 14.
Oh, in those days, that was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. So one day they were picking on me, and they wanted to know why I didn't drink. Now, I always used to quote the Bible. And they wondered, if I didn't drink and I didn't smoke, why was I always quoting the Bible? And I wouldn't tell them why, but the truth was, I memorized the Bible. I love to read. I read everything. I memorized the Bible because every night I would get down and pray that my father would show up the next day. You've heard of a writer named Somerset Maugham?
I sure have.
Wrote Razor's Edge, The Letter, just... He wrote the greatest short autobiography called The Summing Up. He had a similar background. In Of Human Bondage, he gives the lead character a limp. That was supposed to be Somerset Maugham. Somerset Maugham was a homosexual who lisped. And as a young person, he hoped, when he was 11, he hoped he would not lisp. His parents turned him over to his uncle, who was a diehard Christian born again, and taught this young Somerset Maugham that he had to suffer to love God. Well, what Somerset did one day in the dead of winter, got undressed naked, got on the cold floor, and prayed to God that when he woke up and went into the mirror and said good morning, he would not lisp. So he did that. He almost froze to death, got up, went in, opened the door, looked in the mirror and said, okay. From that moment on, he stopped believing in God. And so the same thing happened to me while I memorized the Bible. It was meaningless after a moment. Anyway, these guys are picking on me. And I told them, I said, because they thought I was a religious fanatic when I wasn't. That's why I wasn't drinking and smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, and they kind of bullied me. And so I said, listen, the reason I don't drink is I was working in this store and I stole a carton of beer. And I didn't know what to do with it, so I drank it to hide the evidence. And I threw up all afternoon. Haven't drunk since then.
Was that a true story?
It's absolutely a true story. And I remember the name of the store. It was called Byerly's on Kingston Road.
What was the name of the beer?
You know, I think it was Labatt's.
All right.
Okay, and then I stole a carton of cigarettes. They wanted to know why I didn't smoke. And I tried to hide the evidence. And George, the smoke burned my eyes so much, I thought, even as a kid, how can anybody do this? So I stopped smoking. And then to make them stop picking on me, because they kept talking to me about girls. All they talked about was sex and money and
booze
and beer.
Yeah.
So one night I said to them, I said, listen, I got to confess something to you. A year ago, I stole 12 condoms from the drugstore where I was working. And they stopped and they stared at me. I reached into one pocket, pulled out six, reached into the other pocket, pulled out six. And I said, I still have 12 left. Well, they loved me after that. But what I discovered, that I was gambling, George, not because to make money. I was looking for company.
That's right.
And so I thought to myself, if I am going to do this, I might as well learn what I'm doing. So I went to the library where I had a card. I spent half the time in the library, half the time in the theater. I bought two books. One was called Scarny on Cards. One was called Scarny on Dice. And I memorized them. So when I started to gamble with these guys the next couple of weeks, learning all the odds and permutations of everything, I won.
You started winning.
$700.
Oh, my God. That's like $25,000 today or something.
I'm telling you, it was. I was 15. I hopped on the train to go to Las Vegas because I wanted to come here. My life was to be a gambler. Las Vegas, where I'm living now, strangely enough, is the Vatican. So on the way down here, what happened is that there was an accident on the train, and we had to take a bus to Lake Tahoe. Now, I was 16 years of age.
All by yourself?
All by myself. I had this beautiful blue. The only photograph I have of myself as a young person, aside from those in the police department in Toronto and the immigration service here in the United States, where I was deported when I was like 16 and a half. But anyway, I'm wearing this beautiful suit. I got this Stetson on, and I talked like a 30-year-old. I was at the Cal Neva Lodge playing craps.
Now, how do you get into the... You didn't need a passport in those days, right?
No, you would walk across the border and say, I'm staying in Windsor or Detroit for a couple of days, and then let you through.
That's right. I remember that, because we used to go to Windsor.
I got on a train and came down and sidetracked. Now I'm at the Cal Neva Lodge and I'm playing craps. And it's noisy and it's beautiful and it's like a scene out of the movies. And I'm in absolute heaven. I used to see this in the movies. And now it's in Technicolor. It's not in black and white. And all of a sudden, everybody stops at the table and my back is to the front door. And I'm still looking and trying to roll dice and notice the place gets deathly quiet. And I turn around to see what they're looking at. And guess who comes walking in?
Who?
Frank Sinatra.
No way.
Wearing an overcoat over his shoulders like a cape. And at his side was Sam Giancana.
No.
And behind him, and I recognized Giancana from the newspapers. I read them all the time.
Who's implicated still in the Kennedy assassination, isn't he?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing was that, I mean, I'm staggered because, like, a year before, I'd seen Sinatra in this beautiful Technicolor movie where he sang Old Man River on a pedestal in a white suit.
And he was really thin and small.
Oh,
yeah.
God, and he sang so beautifully, George. It was, and I'm staggered because I'm starstruck by this. Anyway, years later, I get to meet him, I get to work with him, and we become the best of friends for a couple of years. But I didn't know that then. Well, I'm gambling, and one day, and I saw the greatest shows. I saw Joey Lewis and Lily St. Cyr. I saw Noel Coward. Edith Piaf was at the Desert Inn. She sang in a black dress in front of a red curtain, and my God, it was spectacular. Wonderful performance. You could get a great meal, and that, I went to all of them. I'm at a crap table. I'm at the blackjack table. I have never lost. I break even most of the time. And then I realized I was no longer emotionally involved with the game. I got up from the table and quit. Have never gambled since.
Wow.
Got on a train and went to California. And the reason I went to California is because at the end of every movie that I saw, it said Made in Hollywood. So I thought I would go to California. It'd be someplace where I could get oranges in the wintertime.
So how did you come up with, and how old were you, real people?
I was 46. I did not make it until I was 46. Well, I had a lot of unbelievably interesting and exciting things happen to me. I had given, George, everything good that has happened to me, and I swear it, that's happened to anybody, including you, the best things happen by accident. And the worst things are those things that are really well planned.
And sometimes they happen late.
That's right. Look, Jeb Bush and Bernie Sanders' campaigns were well planned. The Vietnam War was well planned. Brad Pitt's lifelong happy marriage was well planned. The Watergate break-in was well planned, but it was only an accident. They caught those guys at the Watergate Hotel. My son was an accident. Every good thing that happened to me happened by accident. Now, if you want to hear how real people happened, or if you'd like to hear the next, I'll just tell you one.
Tell us that one real quick before the top of the hour.
What's that?
Real people.
Well, okay. I was working at NBC as a critic at large without a contract. The reason I had no contract is they wanted to own my material. I didn't want anybody to own my material. I was only making $300 a week. But I noticed coming over the news wires, these unusual stories, and I began to save. The first one I saved, well, they came across a story about the stripper for God. This is this beautiful burlesque dancer in New York who said that God created such a beautiful female body, better than Eve's, that she should show it to men, and the money she earns should go to the church. So she became known as a stripper for God. Another story I came across was called the Dump Club in Louisiana. People who could not get welfare could only collect compensation if they were disabled. And so a number of people who couldn't get jobs took their pistols or their rifles, and they would shoot off a toe or a finger.
Oh, my God.
And they created a club called the Numb Club. So I went around trying to sell. They wouldn't put it on the air because these stories weren't digestible to an audience at the time, and I thought that would make a great show. Now, I have to rewind a bit to tell you this. How real people actually came about. Okay, so I have this, and I get in trouble with a weather girl named Kelly Lang. Does that name ring a bell to you?
Yeah, I heard of Kelly.
Okay, anyway, when I lost the AM show in Los Angeles, which I had created and where I won my first Emmy, and the first time I booked Jim Garrison, I got fired for booking Jim Garrison. We'll get into that story a little later. Anyway, I ended up, and I was the first person in television to do movie reviews. The general manager and the program director of the station said, hey, nobody cares about movie reviews because nobody goes to the movies anymore. But I loved movies because I was a kid who loved movies. I'm on live. So I would do them three times a week. They were so successful, I was hired by Los Angeles Magazine, where I was there for 10 years.
Jeez, you were the Siskel and Ebert before they were even around.
That's exactly right. And what happened is my being on the news only three times a week was responsible for 10% of the news. I wasn't under contract. I was fired twice. Once I was fired because I wanted to review Codename Zorro. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know Codename Zorro? Was a book written by Mark Lane and Dick Gregory based on only factual information from the House Select Committee.
That's right.
I wanted to do the review, right? And my news director says, you're not going on the air with that. I said, but he called it garbage, and he called these guys conspiracy theorists. And I said, listen, Irwin, his name was Irwin Savchik. I said, these guys are just quoting the government, for crying out
loud. Hold on for a second, John. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back and talk more about your career, real people, the Garrison tapes, and phone calls next.